Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Tuesday, July 29th, 2003. Today's session is entitled Louise Erdrich's Sermons, Session 2 of Sermons for the Healing of the World in Contemporary American Literature, presented by Paula Carlson, number CAP 2003-02. Let's listen in.
To say, oh, they don't really look at the whole picture, and of course we do. I don't want to have that word getting around, but there is, literature and religion discussions, we're talking about intellectual issues, we're talking about emotional issues, we're talking about gut issues. So it makes it interwoven kind of discussion. People have been struggling with this issue about literature for a very, very long time. Plato and Aristotle are the two that I always go back to talk about this problem, partly because Christianity is not an issue with Plato and Aristotle. So that lots of times when we talk about the Puritans and books banned in Boston and things, it starts to seem like narrow-minded Bible bangers, things like forbidding literature. And I think that can skew the discussion. So Plato and Aristotle are the two I go back to. Greeks, before Christ, out of the picture in terms of Christianity, then we can move into talking about the way Christians have tended to respond to literature. Plato was Aristotle's teacher, and Plato thought that there were only a very, very few pieces of literature that people should be allowed to read. Homer was not on the list. Homer is the great Greek writer of epics, the Iliad, the Odyssey, which are long poems which were held in the memory of the Greek people for probably 500 years before they were written down. So Homer, the tradition is he was blind, and who knows, there are absolutely no written records about Homer. But he composed these poems. If you read them at some point in school or have picked them up along the way, they're very, very long poems, thousands of lines long. He composed them in his mind. Orated them. Other people heard them and memorized them because they were so moved by the poetry. And then they would recite the poems, and people who listened to them recited the poems. This went on for several hundred years before the poems were written down. So that these poems were clearly treasured by the Greek people because a lot of them went to a lot of trouble to keep them alive in their minds, in their memories. So for Plato to ban Homer was, he was really taking a brave stand there, I guess. But his argument was that the poetry appeals too much to the emotions. And Plato said, we need to base our decisions on reason. Because if we're swayed by emotions, we will do foolish things. In the Iliad and the Odyssey, if you recall, the gods fight among themselves. They fall in love with human beings, and then they kill off other human beings because they're trying to protect the ones they love in battle. And that capriciousness of the gods was particularly disturbing to Plato. He said, it's one thing if human beings are treacherous and treat each other badly, but it's a whole other thing to have the gods being swayed by emotion like this. So that he just thought that Homer was full of trouble and you should stay away from him. He did think that there were a few hymns to the gods that would be okay, but in the Republic, in books 3, 9, and 10, he's pretty severe with drawing the line and taking literature out of the picture. Aristotle, his pupil, on the other hand, was a great lover of Greek drama and wrote a work called The Poetics, and which again some of you probably read in school, and he defended literature. Against the attack of his teacher. He defended Homer some, but he was, I guess, wise in keeping his relationship with his teacher smooth, in that the literature he talks most about in his defense of literature is drama. And Sophocles was his great figure. His great love was Sophocles. Sophocles wrote Oedipus Rex, a famous story of the brilliant man who saved the city of Thebes by cracking the riddle, what animal walks on four legs, two legs, and three legs, and it's a human being, because when babies are little, they crawl. As mature, non-babies, we walk, and we may use canes as we age, so that the riddle is, what animal walks on four legs, two legs, three legs? Oedipus cracks it, saves the city. The Sphinx has put the city under a, a plague, and he becomes the ruler of the city. But then when he goes to the city, the prize for cracking the riddle, for saving the city, is to marry the queen, Jocasta, who is his mother. And obviously it's unfortunate, but Oedipus had been left to die on a mountainside as a baby because his parents, when he was born, had gone to Delphi and heard the oracle, the prophecy that he would kill his father and marry his mother. And when Oedipus, his parents were so horrified by this that they left him out on the hillside to die. But a shepherd found him out there and took him to a childless king and queen in a neighboring country, who adopted him as their son, raised him, never told him he was adopted. And then he heard the oracle at Delphi when he was a young man, so he ran away from home because he was so horrified. And he said, I will never ever do this. And he ended up killing his father and marrying his mother. So Oedipus's tragedy is to run from fate, but run right into his fate. And a very formative story in Greek history, and one that Sophocles told in one of his plays. Sophocles wrote many plays, 70 to 100 plays, we aren't quite sure how many. Aristotle admired them very much, and he argued that going to see these plays, and 20,000 people would do this at a time. In Greek amphitheaters, they built seating up the hills, and they were brilliant engineers, because without a microphone at all, they could have 20,000 people hearing them at one time. And the theaters still exist. I've never been to Greece to walk to them, but I've certainly seen them in lots of videos. But we have someone who's been to the theaters in Greece. And they occasionally people actually do performances in the theaters, probably more than occasionally.
Everybody goes down there and says something. Someone says, way up there, to say, yeah, I can hear you.
And, you know, you can count out and figure out how many people were there. And there were theaters like that in many Greek cities. It was a great mark of civic pride to have a drama festival.
Civilized people.
More like adults.
Yeah, except I suppose less maintenance.
It lasts longer, too.
Yeah, that's right. Here we are, thousands of years later, 2,500 years later. But Aristotle defended the literature of the Greeks, saying that, yes, terrible stories are told, and there are even more terrible stories than Oedipus's. For instance, Medea. Euripides wrote a play about Medea. She was a woman who Jason married her, Jason of the Golden Fleece, and they had some children, but then Jason went off with Ariadne, and Medea was angry, so she killed their children and served them to him for dinner. So this is, I mean, we're talking horrible, horrible things in these stories. But Aristotle argued that to encounter that horror in literature would lead to catharsis, if the literature was great, of course, and he wasn't even too fussy about that, and that the catharsis was a kind of emotional release, an intellectual and emotional release, that would allow people to face the worst and somehow get beyond it. And Aristotle argued that without doing that, if we just shut that down, then we would be maybe finally driven by it. If we repressed it all and didn't face it all, I know I'm doing a little pre-Freudian talk there, but then that could be very damaging to us. So he argued that Plato's banning literature was understandable because these stories are powerful and they are frightening and they can lead people to do things they probably shouldn't do, and they are gut-wrenching in ways that are quite disturbing. And that's something that we need to face in order to move beyond it, not be damaged by that. Truly, we need to face it. So that was Aristotle's argument. And a story like Louise Erdrich has written here in Satan, Hijacker of the Planet, but clearly it seems to me a story that Plato would find problematic and that Aristotle might argue is a story that we can use to learn something about our passions and about our weaknesses. It is clearly, you know, all stops are out. It's a very, very emotional, gut-wrenching kind of story. It's a head, heart, and gut story, and those stories can be profoundly disturbing. I'll tell a few things about Louise Erdrich, and then we can look specifically at the text. Erdrich lives in Minneapolis, Minnesota now. She runs a bookstore called Birch Bark, and I'm told that she's actually in the bookstore fairly frequently. So if you live in Minneapolis or visit Minneapolis, you should wander down to Birch Park at some point.
Where is it?
South Minneapolis. Does anybody know more specifically? I know it's over there.
It's around the lake area by, someplace by Highwater.
Yes, it is. Linden Hills area. And she runs, she has four daughters, and the older daughters help her run the bookstore, apparently. She has, though, lived various places, and, I'll leave it at that. She's lived various places before she came kind of back to Minnesota. She was born in Little Falls and grew up in Wahpeton, North Dakota. Her parents were teachers at the boarding school there that run by the Bureau of Indian Affairs, the BIA boarding school in Wahpeton. She herself is part Ojibwe, part German, and part French. She was raised Roman Catholic. When she graduated from school in Wahpeton, she went to Dartmouth College. So she went to Hanover, New Hampshire.
She's
born 1954, 49.
Because I come from that area. So I was wondering if I went to school with her.
Actually, Louise is her middle name. Karen is her first name. So when she started writing, she took the name Louise to be her pen name. So if you knew her as a child, you would have known her as Karen. But she went to Dartmouth College. Hanover, New Hampshire is a tiny little town way out in the pastoral setting of New Hampshire, so that it's a very kind of enclosed, insulated community. It has a very good program in Native American Studies, and that's probably one reason that she went there. She graduated from Dartmouth and then went to Johns Hopkins and got a Master of Fine Arts in Creative Writing. And she came back to North Dakota and worked as like a highway sign person, weeder of beets, sugar beets, various odd jobs. She also was a poet in residence for the North Dakota public school system, traveled around North Dakota working with school children. She did that for a while, a couple of years, and then she went back to Dartmouth as artist in residence. When she went back, she was there probably 10 or 12 years as writer in residence at Dartmouth. It was during that time that she wrote the novels that made her famous at really a very young age. 1984, her book Love Medicine was published, so she was 30 years old. It won the National Critics Circle Award and a number of others. Became a bestseller. She burst onto the scene at that age with this substantial book, substantial novel. The novel is about a group of Native Americans and it's a fictional reservation in northern, I can't figure out whether it's really Minnesota or North Dakota. Everybody says North Dakota when they talk about it, but you know, it sort of looks more like Leech Lake area to me. I mean, when I read the stories, there are trees and lakes, I think, you know, this doesn't really sound like
that. Yeah, up by Devil's Lake.
So I need to know my North Dakota geography better. But the fictional reservation is called Little No Horse. This is one of her more recent books, The Last Report on the Miracles at Little No Horse, and Little No Horse is the fictional reservation that she writes about. She created a cast of characters in Love Medicine that she's come back to over and over and over again. So if you read her novels, I would recommend reading them in chronological order as she wrote them. She moves around in time quite a bit, so you might not find a straight chronology, but I find it less confusing to read them in chronological order than to drop in here or there. Although this one, I would say start with this one, then go back. If you've never read it before, start with this one, then go back to Love Medicine. One of her distinctive techniques is that she uses something called multiple first-person narrators. So every novel has some narrative voice, somebody who tells the story. Sometimes it's a first-person narrator where the person who tells the story is a character in the story. We learn about that character. Obviously, that character is going to be limited and biased and unreliable to some extent because the character has limitations as a human being. The character can't read other people's minds. So first-person narrators are, by definition, limited. There also are third-person narrators of novels. They can be either third-person limited or third-person omniscient narrators. Third-person omniscient narrators can read characters' minds, so that if you're reading a book and the novelist tells you something like, Mary thought that the gardener was doing a terrible job with the garden or something, but something Mary would never say, but thinks. If the novelist will tell you that kind of information and will tell you it for a number of characters, then it's an omniscient narrator. There also are third-person limited narrators that probably can tell you what one character, maybe two characters are thinking, but not all the characters. So part of the way into a story that we all subconsciously do right away when we start reading is we have to orient ourselves to the narrative voice. Okay, who's telling the story? How am I going to learn about what's going on here? How much can I trust this person? What are these person's limitations? Louise Erdrich makes it much more complicated in her novels because she uses multiple first persons. So she uses the least reliable narrator, and then almost every chapter is told by a different person. So in one chapter, Nanapush will be the narrator. He's one of the Native American characters who comes back over and over again. Another one is Margaret. Another one is, so that every time you change chapters, you change narrative perspectives. This can be confusing, and people have called it kaleidoscopic, which I think is a good image to think about. You do have a pattern, you know, you can stop the kaleidoscope and look and figure it out, but there is change, and you have to get yourself oriented, and then oriented again, and then oriented again. William Faulkner does this too. It's not a technique that she invented. Actually, Faulkner is a really important influence on her. Like Faulkner, Erdrich has this fictional place, the reservation, and writes novel after novel about it, has a whole kind of cast of characters that she comes back to over and over again. Faulkner does the same thing with a county in Mississippi whose name it goes about this long. It starts with Y. Does anybody? Yokanaka or something like that. County in Mississippi. So it's a technique that other writers have used, but it's one that she's used very distinctively and very, very well. After Love Medicine was published in 1984, it was kind of one after the other. She's published about 10 novels since 1984, in 20 years, 10, 12 novels. That's a good clip. That's a really impressive clip. Also, a number of children's books. She's written 2-3 children's books and some collections of essays. Blue Jay's Dance is a collection of essays that she's written. So she's really been a very prolific writer. She's also written a couple of books with a man named Michael Doris. She was married to Michael Doris for a number of years. He was a professor of anthropology at Dartmouth. She met him when she went back to Dartmouth to be a writer in residence. he wrote a book called The Broken Cord. He wrote books, some books on his own. She wrote books on her own, and then they wrote some together, too. And The Broken Cord is a book that some people know. It's a book about his adoption of 3 Native American children who had fetal alcohol syndrome. And there's also a yellow raft on Blue River.
Water.
That is also by Michael Doris, and they are wonderful books. In 1997, Michael Doris committed suicide. And just before he committed suicide, he had been accused of abusing the daughters that he and Louise Erdrich had together in their marriage. So that the end of the story is quite tragic here and quite sad. So I want to tell you the end before I tell you too much about the beginning, so you kind of know where we're going with that. But they have 3 daughters together, and they had this very kind of much talked about and much admired literary relationship because they wrote these books separately, had these different styles, but then they wrote some together, and they talked a lot in interviews about their writing techniques and patterns, and they would write and then read each other's work and then rewrite, and so that even the books that have just their own names on them are collaborative efforts to some degree, but that was obviously not to last. They left Dartmouth 90s, early 90s. From what I've read, they left because the 3 adopted children really continued to have very, very many problems as they grew older, and they became very difficult to deal with in Hanover, which, as I said, is a very small, very ingrown kind of community. And so they actually moved to Kalispell for a while. They lived in Kalispell, and then they moved to Minneapolis. And then the accusations of abuse were made, and the court dates were set, and then Michael Doris committed suicide. Since then, it was after that, Louise Erdrich, understandably enough, kind of went into seclusion and gave no interviews and was really not in public view for a couple of years. But then she started a bookstore and has since had another baby, has about a 2 or 3 year old, and runs the bookstore and has published a couple more novels. Antelope Wife was published, probably 99 or so, and then Last Report on Miracles of Little Known Horses, 2001, and The Butcher's, Master Butcher's Singing Club is a book that came out this year. Master Butcher's Singing Club is a little different. It's a book more about German and Polish settlers in North Dakota. Her other books have been more about Native Americans, certainly interacting with European settlers, but in Master Butcher's Singing Club, which she dedicates to her grandfather, her German grandfather, she talks more about people of German ancestry who live in North Dakota.
Can I ask you a question, everyone?
Yeah.
How old were the children when
the accusation? Probably 14, 12, 10 in that area.
I'm just because of the story. I'm just asking.
Yeah. From when I was working on this book and writing about that particular story. My family and I were sitting around the table at breakfast one day, and we were talking about something that wasn't going so well in somebody's life, and I said, well, you know, things could be worse. You could be a character in story. So that became a kind of running joke. And there's a way in which it looked to me at that point that I'd also just read Blue Jay's Dance, or reread, because when I write, I try to reread as much as I can to get myself in the context. That's a very lovely book. It's a book of nonfiction, and it's a book about their family life in New Hampshire when their children were born. And it's a very lyrical, very beautiful book. And then, you know, to read a story like Satan, Hijacker of a Planet, which is a very devastating story. I think the same person wrote these two stories, you know, within a couple of years of each other. I thought there's such polarization in them. And it's very dangerous as a literary critic to make conclusions on a piece of literature based on an author's life. In fact, for a long time, it would have been considered completely unacceptable for me to stand here and tell you anything about Louise Erdrich at all beside her name. That would have been, it would have marked me as very déclassé in the literary world. I don't know, maybe I am anyway, but there was a theory of reading literature that was in the ascendancy in the United States for many decades, from the 1930s to about the 1970s, called New Criticism. And that was a move away from looking at biographical aspects of an author's life. The piece of literature stood on its own. The author was not important. And to make any conclusions about a piece of literature based on something happening in an author's life was not considered critically okay. That was an interpretive step that was considered so full of room for error that you would never want to do that. And, you know, I guess it's kind of understandable. You don't want the author's life to overshadow the work. You don't want to say, this terrible story was written because Louise Erdrich was trying somehow emotionally to cope with these accusations about her daughters. You don't want to, I wouldn't want to say that.
No.
On the other hand, to argue that her own experience had no impact on the story, it's kind of like, well, where did this story come from then? Or where does literature come from? Or how can literature speak to the human heart if it hasn't come from a human heart? Is a question that I have in response to that. Since the 1970s, New Criticism was in ascendancy for those four decades or so. Very, very powerful, not kind of no way out of it. Then Deconstruction came along and basically smashed everything to bits. If you were in school in the 70s, you maybe remember that. It was like a locomotive going 150 miles an hour coming through academia. Very powerful philosophical movement that started in France right after World War II. People like Jacques Derrida, Claude Lévi-Strauss. There are also a number of Russian linguists, Roman Jakobson, I believe, is very influential. They have different perspectives, but that theory of literature basically upended New Criticism. And then there's kind of been an upheaval every few years since then. We had structuralism and post-structuralism and deconstruction and new historicism. And it's kind of the perspective of the monk club, kind of, you go to literary conferences. So that I would say at the moment there's no dominant philosophical perspective, so we can say whatever we want to, we can go anywhere we want. But I think literary critics are in the process of reestablishing a way of reading literature that we can basically agree on. I think to have a dominant view like New Criticism was for so many decades, and actually like Deconstruction was for maybe 5 or 8 years, that had a moment too where that was it and there wasn't much wiggle room except for that, is fundamentally not good for us as readers of literature because it hems us in too much and it doesn't let you ask certain kinds of questions and it doesn't let you offer certain kinds of commentary. So that I think it's better if we have some kind of kaleidoscopic interpretive possibilities. On the other hand, to be totally at sea doesn't help us too much either. So we're kind of in the process of rebuilding some kind of way of looking at things. And so a lot of people are experimenting with, you know, ways to talk about the relationship between an author's life and then the literature too. Ways of doing literary biography is a field that's getting a lot of attention these days. And that's kind of what we're venturing into too here, talking about Erdrich's life and the stories. It's easier to do it when the people are long dead, so that, you know, people are experimenting with, okay, how to think about Milton and the influence of the Puritan Revolution on Milton and Paradise Lost and his family life. If you know anything about Milton, oh my goodness, but that kind of thing is, it's easier, of course, to control because you get more information about people that can change your perspective, but it's all done. Whatever happened to Milton has happened. Whereas somebody like Erdrich, of course, you know, she's living her life and she's thinking about things and she's an artist speaking to us in our time. It's our art and it's always harder to kind of get a handle on that than it is to look back a little bit. So the question of literary biography with contemporary authors is a very loaded question. In both of these works that I want to look at today, the Satan Hijacker of the Planet and Last Report on Miracles of the Little Horse, there are sermons. And so I've got some copies here that I will pass around, and we can kind of go, I guess, every other one or so again. Maybe we can appreciate it there. And again, there's one that has smaller print and one that has larger print. The second one coming around is from the novel. I'll just hand them both now. It's called The Sermons of the Snakes. So that one. There are copies, paperback copies of this in the bookstore here at Holden, too. And it really is a book that I highly recommend that you read.
Have to be books in heaven, so you think?
Oh, I hope so.
Because you can't read them all in your life.
Which is, of course, a title that gets your attention. The year this book came out, 2000, I spoke to a group of pastors in Colorado, and after we talked, one of the pastors came up to me and said, you know, I had used Vines 1 and 2, so when I saw this, I used it right away, and I talked to him, and he said, why didn't you, in your introduction, tell us how awful this person was? Why didn't you condemn this person more strongly? And I thought, well, okay, and I looked at my introduction, I said, well, I do say he's Satan. And he said, oh, yeah, yeah. But and I think that's an example of how strong this story is in terms of the way it, you know, people respond to it. And it's like, you want to condemn this man. You want to shut Satan down.
You want him
down.
To wear black instead of white is what you want.
Yeah.
You need
yeah.
him to look at.
So, but I think that Erdrich is giving us a very huge clue about what she thinks about this man and calling the story Satan, Hijacker of a Planet, and then also naming him Stan Anderson. So, Satan, Stan, and I think she's saying, you know, blinking light, this guy is evil. I hope that's what she's doing. That would be my assumption of what she's doing. And, you know, the hijacker, yeah.
Are there any copies that people could share with this?
The first one is two-sided, and the second one is one-sided. The second one hasn't made its way around here.
This one, same.
The story here is about a girl who lives in Montana and 16 years old. Her parents argue a lot and loudly, and the story starts with her sitting outside waiting for a storm to come. She sees the storm in the distance, and it's very hot, very oppressive, and the storm is brewing in the distance. And in setting up the beginning of the story that way, Erdrich is signaling us too. It seems to me that we are in an arid landscape, a landscape that is a farm, but that isn't watered, so that it's a landscape that's desperate, that's thirsty, that's parched. And the landscape is a picture of her life. And the storm coming in the distance is Stan, too. In talking that way, I'm interpreting this allegorically, saying, okay, the storm is Stan, and the landscape is the girl. And and I don't want to go too far with that either, because symbols tend to slip out of those kinds of categories, which is a good thing that they do. But on the other hand, I think it's good to see pretty clearly that she's setting us up at the beginning here, I think, to prepare for something cataclysmic to happen to this girl. She's setting us up to hear a story about an evil thing. And the title and the opening tell us, okay, you know, get ready. This is going to be about sin. You borrow a word from Brad. Stan's power is in his language. The thing that enables Stan to woo this girl is his sermon. So that, the title Hijacker of a Planet is, it seems to me, to be a critique of that too. Stan takes a form, the sermon, hijacks it, and uses it for evil purposes rather than for good. So I want to be very clear, and apparently the man in Colorado missed it. So I want to be very clear that I don't think Stan is all right. But his sermon is very good in the sense that it's very effective. Stan comes to the family farm to invite them to this revival meeting, to a tent meeting that evening, and the girl goes, hears Stan preach, and spends the next few years with him, and he sexually abuses her. The narrator of the story, though, is a middle-aged person telling us this story. It's a first-person narrator, so that it's the girl herself telling us the story, but it's not the girl telling us the story as it happened. It's the girl telling us the story as an adult. And at the end of the story, it seems pretty clear. Well, we know, because she says, for several years, I heard this sermon four or five times a day. But now she doesn't. You know. And so she tells the story from outside the relationship, which is a hope for healing in the story, is that she was in this relationship for four or five years, heard this sermon four or five times a day. But now, as the storyteller, she is outside that. It's an indirect hope, of course, because when you read the story, you're in her experience as a 16-year-old girl when she's caught up into the vortex. But for us readers, Erdrich gives us some hope, because the story itself is hope, which is ironic because, of course, the story is so terrible. But she couldn't tell us the story if she weren't outside it. She wouldn't tell us the story this way if she weren't outside it. So the very fact of the story's existence is a sign of hope to us. But kind of telling us the end before the beginning, so we're a little better ready to hear the middle here, on page 119, the sermon starts. The girl tells us in the paragraph right above the sermon, which starts, the stars are the eyes of God, which is a beautiful image, of course. And you know, as we sit here on the chalet porches and look out at the sky, they do seem like the eyes of God. So Stan doesn't get up and announce, I'm an evil person, you know, or I'm, you know, here I am saying, the stars are the eyes of God. He starts with a very beautiful thing. The girl has no beauty in her life, right? But it's an arid desert. Her life is an arid desert. And Stan says, the stars are the eyes of God. And the beauty of that, the insight of that, is a sign of what draws her in. She says in the paragraph right above that, you don't know preaching until you've heard Stan Anderson. You don't suffer with Christ or fear loss of faith, a barbed wire ripped from your grasp, until you've heard it from Stan Anderson.
You don't know subjection, the feral happiness of letting go. You don't know how light and comforted you feel, how cherished. I was too young to stand against it. So she tells us that this sermon makes her feel cherished. She feels held in the hand of God, I guess, by this sermon, which is a sad thing. Stan uses the rhetoric that we associate probably with revival meetings. Get under the bed, get under the sheet. I say to you, stand up. If you fall, fall forward. I'm going to go out blazing. I'm going to go out like a light. I'm going to burn in glory. I say to you, stand up. And so there's one among them. You have heard loose light, Lucifer, the fallen angel. You have seen it with your own eyes, and you didn't know he came upon you in the night and in his own guises, like the hijacker of the planet. He fell out of the air. He fell out of the dark leaves. He fell out of the fragrance of a woman's body. He fell out of you and entered you as though he'd reached the earth, reached his hand up and pulled you down, fell into you with a jerk like a hangman's noose, like nobody, like the slave of the night. Like you were coming home and all the lights were blazing and the ambulance sat out front of the driveway and you said, Lord, which one? And the Lord said, all of them. You too, follow, follow. I'm pointing you down in the sight of the stars and the sight of the Son of Man. The grace is on me. Stand up, I say stand. Yes, and yes, I'm going to scream because I like it that way. Let yourself into the gate. Take it with you. In 4 years, the earth will shake in its teeth. And he's working his way up with his apocalyptic vision of destruction, and then he's going to offer her salvation. One thing that I think is kind of funny here is that in the sermon, part of the sign of resistance of evil is cutting up your credit cards. And he, as he moves in to the middle of the sermon, he says that the numbers on the credit cards, you probably have heard this. There are religious groups.
Aren't the scissors Gabriel's scissors? I mean, he gives the scissors a very...
Yeah, they held the scissors high and turned to every side so the light gleamed. It's the sword of Michael.
Okay.
Held, gleamed off the blades. The sword of Michael, I'm coming down the aisle. I'm coming with the sword that sets you free. And his imagery in the sermon, too, is all about light. The stars are the eyes of God, so that's light. Lucifer, the angel of light, the sword of Michael, the light shines off the sword. So he takes all the imagery of light, the sun, and perverts it and twists it and hijacks it, basically hijacks it, takes it and serves this evil purpose. But he whips this crowd into a froth with the language and has them all cut up their credit cards. And the danger of credit cards is the numbers, because Satan has power over us, according to this perspective on things, with numerology and, you know, the 666. Actually, I read in the paper the other day that they're changing the number of Highway 666 in California because it's too upsetting to people. So now they're having a problem. Everybody's stealing the highway signs because they know when the change is coming. So everybody's out there trying to get their highway signs. So anyway, the power of numbers is what he's working on here, how numbers work. And there is a whole... cultic, thank you, that's the word I was going to say. Vision of numbers is having power, and you need to cut the power of numbers in order to cut the power of Satan. So he has them cutting up their credit cards as a sign of their defiance of Satan. And he moves on to the next town, the next group. A complicating factor here in the girl's experience is that he seems to have a kind of power of healing. They lay hands on people, and people seem to recover in the story. And that's a complicating factor for the girl. So that it's hard to identify the evil for her as a 16-year-old because there's good in it. It seems, you know, that she feels cherished. She hasn't felt cherished in her home. Her parents haven't made her feel cherished. She has a connection with God. She never had a connection with God before. And she, it turns out, she's one of the ones whose ability to see things and helps people, can help heal. She has a gift of healing. And so that coming into this world that's so twisted actually redeems her from a world that is arid and barren and killing. So that complicates it for her as a 16-year-old trying to figure out, well, now I sense the presence of God, but Stan is abusing me. And now I have this gift of insight and healing, but we're using it this other way. And that complexity is too much for her as a 16-year-old, and she doesn't leave. And we don't actually, in the story, we don't hear about her leaving. Yeah.
So
some. And I'll just tell you my perspective, because at the end of the story, the girl tells about a sexual experience that she has with a man, and she describes it in quite positive language. And at the end of the, in the description of that sexual experience, I mean, she's clearly feeling pleasure of a kind. And I would say the reason that I would want to argue no is because of the frame of the story.
And her age. She's too young.
She's looking back as an adult.
Go to high school. So you'll see that. Yeah. It's not that young.
I think she's too young to recognize abuse. She's too vulnerable.
She watches his hands kill the mother, and then those hands touch her. And they touch her beautifully. They touch her wonderfully because she has never been touched before.
Right.
She's never had that wonderfulness. But it goes to him dominating her right away. And he knows what he's doing. He's a man. He knows what he's doing.
And there is the end of the story.
Wait,
there's
read some of the other stories in this book.
There's room for there's room for this argument in the story. Erdrich doesn't shut it down entirely.
Why I came to it is as he asks her what she saw. And to me, I don't see him as evil. I see him as someone who has had this conversion experience. He knows very little about it. And so he's gone over the edge and now is preaching and doing stuff about inner background and knowledge. And he asks her what she sees. And for me, it's too much because she's obviously seen pain in his own past. And so I saw these two kind of mixed up, unhappy people having this, yeah, a twisted sexual relationship, but I didn't see it as total abuse. I saw her as this coming together of these two people who are clearly hurting in the story, and that as much as he's older and dominant, I don't actually see her as too young or completely resistant to what happens. In the end, I think she grows older. Yeah, she looks back and says, well, that was probably, you know, the result of age. But I never, in part because of some of the language, of him putting his mouth on her, and at the end, you know, it sounds fairly orgasmic to me. The language that she uses is not. If
I think it's pretty clear.
I would be a little more concerned. 16 to me, in this stage, is not that young because he's, you know, as much as people think of that.
I think the story of Lucifer is, obviously I'm bringing it up, I think it's helpful to bring it up here. Lucifer, of course, the angel who's kicked out of heaven, the most beautiful of them all, sits on God's chair, thrown out. And in that story, there's light. In this story, Lucifer is an angel of God. Lucifer's sin is wanting to be like God. That's clearly a sin. As I say, we need to stick with Brad, too, to get our sins defined here. But the Bible says that people are made in the image of God. So to connect in the way that Lucifer does with God, to want to sit on God's throne, I'm not advising it, don't. But it seems to me to be a kind of, it's not a clear picture to me. It's not that's absolutely, entirely, completely awful, terrible, evil thing. And I think that's one reason she brings Lucifer in as much as she does, because he's so complex in that way. He's light, but he's darkness. He's beauty, but he's evil. And I think it would be nice if we could all clearly identify agents of evil. I appreciate that in my life, you know, it's okay. That person I know, you know, and that's the one's got the mark of Cain. I'm staying away from that. But, you know, even Cain with his mark of Cain, God had pity on him, and, you know, even Cain, you feel like, well, so then I think she's not wanting to make it so evil is unambiguously evil. I agree with you about that. Yeah.
I'm just wondering, like, from a purely more literary standpoint, how does the use of scripture and the quoting of scripture, does that change the tenor of the story? Both yesterday's story, James Baldwin's autobiographical story, and this story today, in terms of the function of how the sermon works within a story. Because they're quoting from another source. In some ways, the argument today is this one is, he's quoting in a way that's not life-giving, and the sermon,
well,
or Baldwin was
I guess I would say it's sort of life-giving. I mean, and that's where we come into that.
cherished. She said she had never felt cherished before, and the sermon makes her feel cherished. She connects with God. She's never connected with God before, but now she can see the eyes of God. So it's sort of life-giving. So the Bible. I think Baldwin is closer to the Christian tradition than Erdrich is. I mean, I'll start with that. So that I think his uses of the Bible are more like traditional Christians would use the Bible. Erdrich is in another interpretive framework, and while she clearly knows the Bible very well, and if you, you know, when we talk for a couple of minutes here about the last report on Miracle Little No Horse, you can see again how she's biblically based, but she's looking to other traditions as well. Whereas Baldwin is in contention with the Christian tradition and had some experience with Islamic tradition when he was in the Islamic countries, but he was influenced by Malcolm X, but not so that he embraced Islam. Whereas Erdrich is more open to a kaleidoscopic religious perspective, too. So that in Last Report on the Miracles of Little No Horse, Catholicism is definitely there, a real presence and a powerful presence in the story, but so are traditional Ojibwe religious perspectives. And it is more a mix of things, whereas Baldwin is more... he's in contention with Christianity, but it's Christianity.
I'm also thinking of like a sermon is more first order kind of speech. When you talk about text, you know, if you write a commentary on Revelation, you mean second order work. If you're preaching on a text from Revelations, you're preaching the word of God for that morning, for that group of people. Whereas if you're writing a commentary on Revelations, it's a different kind of work that you're doing.
Mm-hmm.
Does that first order work essentially change the tenor of the language, or is it just sort of all part of this make-believe fictional world that people are living in?
Well, fiction is a hard thing to define too. And you know, as I said in the beginning, how much her life affects this is... fiction can be very close to real life, too. So even if it is all fictional, it still, it seems to me, is plugged into real life. I don't know, actually, of fictional uses of the second order. I think that would not happen much. So that when we think about the way sermons are used here as opposed to somewhere else, I suppose it would be the way sermons are used in churches. So the sermon in the story vis-a-vis the sermon in a church. And... to my eye, it seems quite similar. But that, you know, we may have disagreements about that too, because we're into interpretive levels there where there's some room. But it seems to me that both Erdrich and Baldwin are in their works, and these other people I'm going to talk about this week too, wanting to echo people's real experiences of sermons in church, and so that they would be wanting it to be as close as they can. My guess is that Erdrich heard preachers like this on the radio. I don't know, maybe you've driven through Montana looking for something to keep you awake as you drive. And Garrison Keillor says a great story about somebody driving back to Lake Wobegon for Christmas or Thanksgiving, and she's trying to stay awake, so she turns on the radio preacher. He scares her so much she wakes right up. And that's the kind of, so that, you know, I've heard them too, as you're kind of trying to get to the place where they actually have a hotel or something. I'm sure she heard the preacher's one way or another, and then is trying to echo that in the piece.
Going back to the storm, it starts with the storm, but when the storm comes, the water does not get to them. It's just light rain, evaporates before it lands, and
right.
Then rains somewhere else. What's that tell you about that relationship?
Well, you know,
so that's why I think the relationship was not a good one.
Well, I'm not saying it's good. There's a difference. Consensual sex and a good relationship is what I'm trying to say.
Yeah, it may have been consensual, but...
To go from good to good.
And here, I think one of the hard things is that the healing is hinted at mostly by the fact that she's no longer in the relationship. I mean, if we want to read the relationship as destructive in one way or another, then the healing is that she's no longer there. We don't have a rainfall at the end of the story.
We don't have the landscape transformed.
But you know, it's interesting, Kev, a few years ago, not long ago, I took a class, I went to a weekend where you took your wounded child, that's what she was there, as an adult, and you imagine yourself protecting that wounded child. And that's what the story does, I think. She's seeing herself now as an adult looking at that child and getting an understanding of it.
Something kind of different, but in both cases, in Baldwin and in Erdrich, I'm impressed at the power that those sermons had to reach those people and the resulting, you know, in James Baldwin's case, kind of the conversion or the understanding more of his father in a very kind of powerful way. And here, the ability of this Satan to hijack seems to have been so tremendously effective. And, you know, I think I sort of listen to sermons with less emotional I've been doing it faithfully, listening mostly to the same person for 50 years. And that is, you know, my experience. But these people's lives, and I was thinking, that's kind of a cautionary tale for pastors. Both are cautionary tales. What I'm saying up here is maybe not going to get to Marjorie Carlson very much, but it may get to some needy person up here.
Well, and I suppose, of course, that's the point. That would be the point.
But it certainly impresses me.
The second sermon, which is very short, thankfully enough, because we have only very short time left, is a sermon to snakes. There actually aren't any people in the church when Father Damien preaches this sermon, so we can use that as a transition into the last report on Miracles of Little Nell Horse. The one-sided sheet that I handed out, where I circled there, the sermon to the snakes, as I read, came on this, is a sermon that Father Damien, the priest in this story, preaches to snakes in the church. He's in the church preparing for Sunday, and the snakes come out, and he preaches to them and then falls asleep for a long time. To summarize this book, to get us to this point, page 226 and 7, where we hear the sermon, I will spare you that. But I will tell you a couple of things, and that is, read this book, first of all. But secondly, Erdrich in this book tells the story of many of the characters that she's told stories of in Love Medicine, Deep Queen Tracks, Tales of Burning Love, all those earlier novels that established her. And the earlier novels have a lot of the searing sense of Satan, Hijacker of the Planet. I'd say with this book, she turn, and there's a more lyrical quality to her writing that's more like Blue Jay's Dance, more like her nonfiction before. And this book and Master Butcher's Singing Club have this much stronger lyrical part to them. They still have, it's still, evil is a presence, but it's not so gut-wrenching, I don't think, as the Satan Hijacker Planet kind of writing that is in those earlier works, too. If you've read them, Sister Leopolda, for instance, probably made an enormous impression on you. She's one of the nuns on the reservation. She stabs children so that they have stigmata. She claims all these miracles. I mean, she is a really perverse character. And there's also Father Damien, who's a priest in these earlier books. He doesn't show up too much, a little bit, though. But in this book, he's the central character. Sister Leopolda is also a really important character here, too. Part of the framework of this book is a man named Father Jude has been sent to the reservation to decide whether or not they should canonize Sister Leopolda. Because, I'll stay away. But there are these traditions of some miracles associated with her. So Father Jude has come to investigate. Father Damien is, of course, on to Sister Leopolda. And he's a very, very old man when Father Jude comes. And the framework of the book is, part of it is Father Damien's conversations with Father Jude to try to help Father Jude understand that maybe they should not canonize Sister Leopolda. Another part of the framework is that Father Damien has been writing to the Pope ever since he got to Little No Horse, because when he got there and realized what the lives of the native people there were like, he thought, we have to do something, you know, this is not good. And he starts writing letters to the Pope, appealing for help, this is it, this is life here, what should I do? And the Pope never responds until the very, very end, And there are some very clever letters at the end, too, that Erdrich claims to have gotten a hold of. She pulls herself into the story at the very, very end of the story, claiming that she's gotten all the letters from Father Damien. And that's the basis of the novel. Of course, that is all fictional. But we think, who knows? But the last report, then, is the last letter that Father Damien writes to the Pope. And there have been these stories of miracles at the reservation. Father David has been writing reports. So the last report before he dies is a very, very old man, is what gives the title to this book. It turns out, too, that Father Damien is actually a woman. And in telling you that, I hope I'm not spoiling things, because I hope, because we find that out very, very early on in the story. And the story of how a woman came to be the priest at this reservation is a very interesting one. And it's about the first third of the book, first quarter of the book. She actually starts out life as a nun and then ends up the priest on this reservation, but there's stuff in between, too. And I think the fact, Erdrich writes about this very, in a very kind of committed way. And it seems to me in this book she's taking Roman Catholicism seriously as a powerful force within these people's lives, a force for the good. She's also taking it theologically seriously, maybe not in a way the Pope would approve of. although the last letter in the is a letter from the Pope. I don't suppose that John Paul II was actually penning it, but that would be the way that it's set up to be, you know, read from him, and it's a rather sympathetic letter. So she's struggling with Roman Catholic hierarchy, which is her own religious tradition, but coming to terms with it in some ways, defying it in other ways. And she also writes a lot in the book about Native American spirituality and the way that that contributed to the life of the people on the reservation. And Father Damien and a group of Native Americans kind of come to some interesting understandings about Roman Catholic theology in the light of Native American spirituality. So this Sermon to the Saints is a kind of statement of Father Damien's vision of truth, what he's come to see after years of being pretending to be a man on this planet, on this reservation, and being a minister to these people. He says, what is the whole of our existence, practicing his sermon from the new pulpit, but the sound of an appalling love? The snake slid quietly among the feet of the empty pews. What is the question we spend our entire lives asking? Our question is this: are we loved? I don't mean by one another. Are we loved by the one who made us? Constantly we look for evidence. In the gifts we are given, children, good weather, money, a happy marriage perhaps, we find assurance. In contrast, our pains, illnesses, the deaths of those we love, our poverty, our innocent misfortunes, those we take as signs that God has somehow turned away. But, my friends, what exactly is love here? How to define it? Does God's love have anything at all to do with the lack or plethora of good fortune at work in our lives? Or is God's love perhaps something very different from what we think we know? Divine love may be so large it cannot see us, or it may be so infinitely tiny that it works on a level where it directs us like an unknown substance buried in our blood. Or it may be transparent, an invisible screen, a filter through which we see and hear all that is created. Oh, my friends, the snakes lifted their bullet smooth heads, flickered their tongues to catch the vibrations of the sounds the being made somewhere before them. I am like you, said Father Damien to the snakes, curious and small. He dropped his arms. Like you, I poise alertly and open my senses to try to read the air, the clouds, the sun slant, the little movements of the animals, all in the hope I will learn the secret of whether I am loved. The snakes coiled and recoiled, curved over and underneath themselves. If I am loved, Father Damien went on, it is a merciless and exacting love against which I have no defense. If I am not loved, then I am being piteously manipulated by a force I cannot withstand either. And so it is all the same. I must do what I must do. I go in peace.
Oh, read the last part.
No, the last, okay. He lifted his hand, blessed the snakes, and then lay down full length in a pew and slept there for the rest of
the day. I'm sure the snakes slept too.
Yeah, that's why he settled down. Warm afternoon. This is a perspective that's very similar to one she articulates in Master Butcher's Singing Club, too. So it seems to me to be one that she seems for a while here anyway, settled in on. Kind of the, it's an agnostic stance, fundamentally. It's, I don't know if I'm loved or if I'm not loved. But in a way, it's all the same. And as a Christian reader, there might be some discussions I might want to have with her, but the perspective she's struggling with here is clearly, she clearly places it within a religious context. And in this story, as opposed to the other one, there's more a sense of harmony is the wrong word. coming to peace with it. I don't think she's done struggling with the questions yet, but I think she's at a place where she's starting to think of some ways to put together a framework that is coherent for her. I have a bit of a video. It's not with her, though, so which is probably why I left the room. She doesn't like to be interviewed, or it wasn't to be. But apparently she's not averse to meeting people in her bookstore, so you can go see her. The other three sessions, the rest of this week, we actually have interviews with the authors. So Sue Miller, Tilly Olson, Oscar E. Willis, show you interviews with the folks themselves. This interview is of a professor talking about her. It's not someone who knows her well, like yesterday David Lehman talking about Baldwin. It's almost like a member of the family talking about him. So this was a professor talking, and we'll let him sit on the video. And the videos are available from Oxford Fortress. So they're in lots of Lutheran Synod libraries and stuff. You can check them out. Actually, if you'd like to see the interviews here, let me know. You can borrow my tape anytime and watch as many as you want to. But it is lunchtime, coming close to lunch, and thanks for coming. And the next session is Thursday at 5:05. I'm seeing myself on the calendar there. And we will talk about Sue Miller. I was gone. Okay, thanks.